So, shall we start? I'm going to do one of those sort of the story so far summaries at the beginning. I know there are some people here that have not been here on previous evenings, and those of you that have been here on previous evenings may not have remembered very much. And I don't blame you, but there we are. I'm using a computer as my notebook, which isn't the best thing to do, but since I don't have a printer here, it's the only thing I can do. So see if you agree with this summary. First of all, the mind, which is the source of the logismi, or thoughts, creates an awareness of a shallow or somewhat false sense of self. The story, or perhaps drama would be a better word, with which this shallow self concerns itself throughout life, is, collected altogether, the ego of that particular person. As a result of the fall, this sense of self is broken. And although it mimics reality, it is, in fact, an invention of the individual person and not real at all. In this scheme, the ego is not a part of the personality, unlike the scheme which Freud uses. It is rather a story told by the logismi in the mind. However, there is a deeper self, and we might want to say a more real self, which is to be found in what the fathers variously call the heart, the nous, or the soul. This key element is often hidden and almost always ignored throughout Western civilization. However, it is through this nous that we have the ability for direct contact with God, or, in the words of St. John Chrysostom, the possibility of finding the gate to the kingdom of heaven. So our journey starts as a physical journey. This isn't simply a mental exercise. God isn't a mental image. It's a physical journey, starting with a physical point in our physical bodies and meeting God there. The third factor can only be tested against the experience of each individual, by which I mean pretty much. There's no way of knowing that how I feel and think and understand is ever going to be anything like what you feel and think and understand. We have no way of testing that. For example, I look out of the window there and I see grass and I say that grass is green. And you also look out of the window and you see grass and you say that grass is green. But we have no way of knowing that what I'm experiencing and what you're experiencing is the same thing. We can't test that. There is nothing to test. So this journey will have certain very personal elements in it, which you can't test against the experience of anybody else, because it won't make any sense in the context of somebody else's life. Yesterday, and I think a little unfairly, I threw in some of my alcoholic history just to show some of the shape to what my experience is. If you take that part away from me, I'm like a Christmas tree without any leaves or without any pines or without any, needles. You can't do that. That's part of who I am, part of my experience, and that's part of what this person experiences on the way to God. Now, most of you don't have alcoholism in your histories. You probably have other things, which I don't have. But we can't play off against each other. Nor can I say my way is better than yours or yours than mine. That wouldn't make any sense at all. In fact, that would be a sin against charity. modern psychotherapy demands that we find a place for the emotions. In the West, we have come to adopt a rather unexamined notion that these somehow belong to the heart. But this is not the way the Orthodox fathers understood the situation at all. Instead of associating emotions with the heart, it seems more straightforward and in line with Orthodox teaching if we treat the emotions simply as the reactions of the physical body to our thoughts, the thoughts which emanate from the mind. So our feelings are to do with the mind, not to do with the heart. The heart is beyond feeling. The heart is deeper than feeling. There's an immediate problem here. The desire to label and the ability to define things is expressly an activity of the mind. The heart is largely unconcerned with this sort of definition. Just as the mind demands knowledge, so the heart is content with awareness. Seemingly related, these two words, knowledge and awareness, do much to sum up the huge gulf which exists within our own personalities. In our condition, this broken condition of fallen man, we have to use the tools of the mind to talk at all, even when we are talking about things beyond the mind. Perhaps as we progress spiritually, it will become less necessary to share words and become more possible to share awareness in a more direct manner. You hear stories of both in the Desert Fathers and in contemporary Orthodox life, of saints getting together and simply sitting in silence together and communicating in that way. I can't let you go away from here thinking that Father Mel's got a down on thinking. Thinking is somehow bad. No, thinking is not bad. Thinking is given to us by God. In fact, it's when it's necessary and useful, it's very necessary and very useful. And is one of the highest capabilities that God has given us. I think what we can say, though, is that according to what the fathers have said, since the fall of mankind, or since the fall of creation, which is the Orthodox teaching, it's not just man that's fallen, it's the whole of creation. Since the fall, this thinking has gone out of hand. Our thinking has been distanced from our hearts and has suffered as a result. Unfortunately, as a result of the fall, there is a dysfunction of the heart also. And is that young lady here who brought up the heart, the Jeremiah verse? No? Oh well, don't worry. That's fine. This really touches a little bit on that. As a result of the fall, there is a dysfunction in the heart. One powerful image comes to us from the prayers we use at Vespers for Pentecost. Here we see the noose described as a mirror. It's like a mirror, and as a mirror, it's a beautiful example of what it means to be fully human. When we are healthy, this mirror mirrors the grace of God, which is the most that any human being has to offer. The cleaner the mirror, the more polished it is, the more clearly it reflects the glory of God. However, as a result of the fall, this mirror has been covered with dust. Sometimes the dust is so thick that it is not possible to see that there is, in fact, a mirror beneath the dust. It simply looks like a dusty pile. However, once we start to clean the mirror, which is essentially the work of the Holy Spirit in prayer, then the mirror slowly comes into view once more, and the dust is gently swept away from its surface, and the light can reflect once more. The mind and the heart have been alienated from each other, and the result is that the mind has started to function on its own, separately from the heart. The heart, meanwhile, has been almost entirely hidden from view, or at least obscured by dust. The next part is a little bit experimental, and if you feel embarrassed about doing experimental things, then just don't do what I ask you to do. That's fine. There's no compulsion here. What I'd like you to do is to attempt to listen to the following passage with your heart and not with your head. Now, the way to do that is not easy, and certainly until you get used to it, it's actually quite difficult. The mind doesn't have an off switch. It chunters along, whether you're listening to it or not. Most of the time, I have to say, we're not listening to it. It's like a background noise. We all experience this somewhat differently from each other. Some people describe it as a sort of a spinning wheel. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. Other people, like a revolving door. Other people talk about a committee in the head. This doesn't imply that they're schizophrenic. It simply means that they're... all of us hear voices to a greater or lesser extent. Sometimes they are voiceless voices. But there are different dynamisms in your personality, and some of them, sometimes they're stronger and sometimes they're weaker. If I might just demonstrate what I mean by that. You have a beautiful church upstairs with acoustics to die for. As you come in, say you come out from where I'm staying, St. James House, I leave my room and I walk towards the church. I actually go through a transformation as I come towards the church. By the time I get to the church door, I'm not exactly the same person that I was when I left my room. In my room, I'm sort of at home. It's a private space. I don't have to be on show, except when the windows are open. I've been waving at people all day. It's quite nice, really. But who's the young man that went off to be a chef at 6:30 this morning? Is he here?
Chris.
No. I've been observing you all day, all of you. I come to the church door and I come into that vestibule area, which is like an exonarthex, or is it the narthex? It is the narthex. Okay. The exonarthex is, in fact, the church steps, then. And by the time I open the door and come into the narthex, I'm not the same person as I was when I was outside. When I come to the next door, a fairly radical change takes place. The point at which most people stop and make the sign of the cross. You know what I mean? So we're actually undergoing a transformation which the building is doing for us. And if you happen to be a clergyman and you go into the Holy of Holies, yet another transformation takes place. I am not the same person standing at the altar as I would be standing at the choir desk, and I'm not the same person standing at the choir desk as I am out on the grass. Put another way, those of you who are mothers and have children, you are not the same person to your mother as you are to your child. You're the same person. Of course you are. Yes, I'm not saying that. But you approach your mother in one way, you approach your child in another way. We all of us have these different parts. This is the result of the fall. Sometimes we can swing from being very happy to being very sad, and there's no real reason. We wake up one morning and we're just feeling down in the dumps. And we let people know sometimes, punish them for our feelings. That makes a lot of sense. Sometimes these parts get so far away from each other they don't actually work together anymore. And that becomes something approaching a psychopathology, and becomes very complicated. Then you end up being multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, as we're calling it this year. Why do they have to do that? I never understand things like that. I've pressed buttons here by mistake. This isn't good. Okay, so simply allow yourself to relax. It's not a difficult thing to do. Just relax and be aware that your mind is ticking over. Push it to one side. Don't fight with it, because it fights back. The more you fight with it, the harder it pushes back. So don't never try to do that. Just gently brush it to one side. And if you can, bring the focus of your attention down to, say, about there. And I'm going to read a passage. Actually, I'm sort of cheating a bit, because this is Jim's spiritual father speaking. At the center of our being is a point of nothingness which is untouched by sin and by illusion. A point of pure truth. A point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes of our lives. A point which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our mind or the brutalities of our will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God in us. It is, so to speak, His name written in us. As our poverty, as our indigence, as our dependence, as our sonship and daughtership is like a pure diamond blazing with invisible light from heaven, it is in everybody. And if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this seeing. It is only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere. And then my spiritual father adds, in this passage, Merton does not actually use the word heart, but surely he is referring with insight and precision to what the Christian East means in its ascetic and mystical theology when it refers to the deep heart. Now you can either come back or stay where you are, that you can choose. We switch from the words of man to the words of God. Reading from the Gospel according to St. Luke. Now it happened, as they went, he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his words. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she approached him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore tell her to help me. Jesus answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things. But one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen that good part which will not be taken away from her. At this point, you might want to come back to ordinary mode, otherwise you're going to wear yourselves out. It's a bit difficult. Now I have that wonderful reality of being able to talk to you for the next 33 minutes about silence. When we look at that image of the two sisters in the Gospel, one of the things that takes me as it were unawares is the fact that if I'm sitting in a house, this sometimes happens, clergy get invited all over the place, if I'm sitting in a house and somebody's talking to me and then an irate sister comes in and says, hey, what's going on here, why aren't she can't sit down, I've been slaving about all day and this, that and the other, and the chances are I would say, okay, well, I'll come and help you. But I think it's quite important that we realize that Jesus doesn't say that. He most certainly does not say that. Not only that, he turns to Martha. Martha, after all, is the one who deserves the sympathy, doesn't she? She's the one that's out there slogging it. And Mary's just sitting. But as we go into a gospel like this, we go into deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper level, and we suddenly realize that, of course, Mary isn't just sitting. What Mary is at that point is present in the presence of the Lord. Martha is caught up in the drama of things. The potatoes are burning and the lamb is off the boil and the cabbage isn't coming out quite right. And besides, they forgot to deliver this, that and the other, and I'm not sure the table is set right and so on. She's caught up in the drama. And this is exactly the same as someone being caught up in the lightning and the wind and the fire in the Elijah story. And it's our entire lives. It's that soap opera of existence that we call life. And the details, and the gossip, and the exchange of information, and how important we think this is, and how unimportant we think that is, and whether this is better than that. And it's all mind stuff, and we share it, and it goes in worlds and worlds and worlds and worlds and worlds, and it gets us absolutely nowhere. And yet it is the very substance of our daily lives. By definition, a soap opera is a story that has a lot of drama, but no there. And a lot of human lives, including my own, can be just like that. All drama and no there. And the very point of this story that I have found, and you might find others, is that Mary has found the there. And suddenly, if you're in the there, the drama looks rather stupid. And here you see a sister sitting on the floor, being present in the presence, looking at a sister who's caught up in the drama, and being almost unable to say anything that would have any meaning at all. So Jesus does it for her. It's interesting how he puts that phrase, there is only one thing that is necessary, period. Then another sentence, Mary has chosen the best part and it will not be taken away from her. It's a non sequitur. If you read the English and indeed the Greek, it doesn't flow. It's not Mary's chosen the best part, therefore or because something is. Mary has chosen the best part. One thing is needful. Mary has chosen her, and it will not be taken away from her. The same could be said for any one of us who enters into, who is present in the presence. to tie this in with what we've been saying on previous days then, Mary is in her heart and Martha is stuck in her head. And far from having sympathy, and sympathy really isn't a very necessary commodity for anybody, but that's sort of counselor speak, I have to admit. Jesus has no sympathy for the drama, because he's seen something more important going on with Mary. And what is Mary doing? Precisely nothing. And that is the icon of prayer. She is sitting in the presence. She could have been standing, but she happens to be sitting. She's present in the presence. That is prayer. It has a quality about it, though, that we need to look at a little more carefully. The fathers call this quality nepsis. Well, I can write it on the board if you like. It won't do you much good, because it looks like that in English. It's not very good, is it? It means, well, I'll tell you what it means. And I borrow this from a non-Christian source. It's what a cat does when it's watching a mouse hole. It sits there perfectly still, watching the mouse hole for hours on end. But it is perfectly attentive. That's nepsis. And the fathers of the church, by fathers I also of course include the mothers, the fathers of the church say that's what prayer should be like. We are completely relaxed and completely alert at the same time. Our bodies are relaxed, our hearts are alert. Completely relaxed, completely focused. When you see the priest standing at the altar, that's what he's trying to achieve. It's sometimes when we got to worry about parish councils and choir. Well, I don't know about you guys. Choirs, and have they put the coffee stuff out, and is that person coming to read the epistle, and what about the coliver, it's very difficult sometimes. But my job on a Sunday morning is simply to be present in the presence. And sometimes it's very difficult indeed. St. Ignatius, that's our St. Ignatius, not the Spanish one. I'm particularly fond of St. Ignatius because I was born on his birthday. I also bear the name of another Antiochian saint. So, St. Ignatius of Antioch describes Jesus Christ, and he's writing in the 2nd century. He describes Jesus Christ as the word that came out of silence. So this silence isn't simply a thing. It isn't simply a quality, and it certainly isn't a lack, an emptiness. This is a full to overflowing silence, which is the presence of God himself, and it's from that silence that the word, and there is a word play there, the logos of God, which means word, the word was made flesh, sort of thing, comes from. Tomorrow we'll be looking more carefully at the Jesus Prayer, but I have to let you know that one of the factors of the Jesus Prayer which intrigues me most of all is not just the words, but the silence in the space between the words. Gerard Manley Hopkins, a very famous English poet, Jesuit of, as again I want to say last century, but you know, the one before, he talked a great deal about the way in which words in a poem all interact with each other. So a word on line 5 interacts with a word on line 3, say. I mean, every word interacts with every other word in the poem. And he called the tension between these words inscape. He invented a term. And somehow we've got to be able to get used to the notion of spiritual inscape. If you look and prod, there's nothing there because it's silence. There's nothing to grasp. You see, and our minds are infuriated by that because our minds can't do anything with anything they can't grasp. And they get frustrated. But the deeper you go into silence, the greater the tension within the silence becomes, the greater the inscape, if you like, if you want to adopt that particular word. Our hearts love silence, our minds hate it. And the first thing they'll do is try to fill it. And we do it with distraction. And distraction can be anything, from knitting to Bartok, from Van Gogh to college football. It doesn't really matter whether it's high class, you know, concerts and cocktail parties, or low class, beer and skittles. It's still distraction. Most of what we do is distraction. Do you realize this is what's going on? Feeding your minds, just keeping them quiet and occupied because they hate silence. If you have, those of you who are parents, and particularly grandparents, have a terrible urge to wave something in a baby's face. Rattle, 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 rattle. From the moment that it's born, you try to fill its silence with distraction. Put it down in front of Sesame Street, or the Teletubbies, or whatever else you can find it. It keeps it quiet that way. Well, of course it keeps it quiet that way, but the trouble is, you're spending its silence. You're spending its being time for him or for her. And that little body will just grow up to be a miniature soap opera like the rest of us. If he or she continues down that path. That's all a soap opera is. It's simply distraction. Useless distraction. I'm not against distraction altogether. I'm no Puritan in this matter. I mean, let's face it, distraction is wonderful. But if it's distraction at the cost of no silence, no heart, then it suddenly becomes a rather tragic way of behaving. We turn the radio on the minute we get into the car. We have noise nowadays in the shower. I said to Father Mark this morning, I'm ashamed at the number of toys I have. I've got an iPod, I've got a computer, I've got a thing that tells me where I should be and when. I've got a phone that I thought I could call California, but I can't. All the stuff. It's all distraction. Distraction, distraction, distraction. It might make me feel important from time to time, which is a bit silly, let's face it. But it's basically distraction and nothing more than distraction. This is also true of Dostoevsky. He writes Distraction. And it's also true of, you know, punk culture. That is simply distraction too. The possible exceptions to this would be words that are used to address the heart. And there is a theory, I was discussing it with some people at breakfast this morning, there is a theory that the definition of literature as opposed to other sort of writing isn't fusty and boring, which most people think literature is, but is in fact addressed to the heart rather than simply to feed the mind, simply to feed, to be another distraction. True silence is the awareness of God. And that awareness has to be without our intervention. If we project onto God who God is, then we've made a false image already. We've made a false icon. And if we pray to that icon, it's idolatry. That's a bit harsh, but I'm afraid that's the reality. If we invent God and then pray to him, it is idolatry. St. Callistos, after whom Bishop Callistos is named, says this: pray without images, shapes, or forms, with a nous and a soul that are entirely pure. Always keep your nous, your heart, your soul, whatever you're going to call this quality, Always keep your nous free from color, free from form, free from shape and configuration, and free from any quality or quantity. Prayer in silence, this deep silence, is not analysis, it's encounter. It's not abstract reflection, it's invocation, or I think I prefer conversation. The moment you engage with an icon, you are in relationship with it, and there is communication. That's why icons depicting saints, not depicting events, that's a slightly different thing. That the ones that depict events started their lives as frescoes on the walls. Some of them have now been transferred to pieces of wood like this and will show people sideways on. But an icon always is front on. You look straight into the eyes, because without that contact, we as human beings don't know what to do. We have to look into people's eyes to know who they are. There's a nice old story that Bishop Calistus tells. Most of this stuff comes from Bishop Calistus. You know that story. If he was here last year, he must have told you the thing about at the beginning of the talk, he puts his hands up like this and then talks and talks and talks. And at the end of the talk, he puts his hands like this. Well, they're the speech marks. You know, they're the inverted commas, because I'm quoting from him all the time. And sometimes I'm quoting from him and I know. And sometimes I'm quoting from him and I don't know. And sometimes I don't know that I don't know. But I think this is another story of his about an old man who goes into a village church. I don't think it's an Orthodox church, because I think he speaks with an English accent. But he just goes and sits. And somebody says to him one day, "What are you doing there? You seem to go in every day. What are you up to?" And he replies, "I just sits here. Sometimes I speaks to him. Sometimes he speaks to me. But mostly I just sits." Crude perhaps, but a very, very clear image of what prayer is. Prayer is mainly silent. Sitting in the company of someone you love. Sometimes there is talk. Sometimes we need to say to God, "Abba, something's going on in my life." Of course, it's not as if God doesn't know already. So it's a sort of an odd conversation. And sometimes he speaks to us. And it won't be in ways that we readily understand. You won't hear a voice out of the clouds or anything. At least I shouldn't think so. But he'll communicate with you nevertheless. If you are deeply into your silence. I'm fairly certain that in a fallen state, God is not able, now there's a statement, God is not able to communicate with your minds directly. I don't think our minds are available to him directly. That much in the same way as the will of the human being can stop the power of God dead in its tracks. If I choose to shut God out, I have the power to do that. My will is stronger than God. That's an area of theology that we don't go into very often. It's a bit dodgy. I would have to say that in general terms, all of us speak too much. Yak, 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 yak. And about 97% of what we say is completely unnecessary. We repeat things over and over again, as if it makes it more true if we say it more than three times. We use words carelessly. If we had to pay, 20 cents for every word we spoke, we might actually get better at doing this than we are. We waste so much energy in useless communication. And the path of the Hesychast, the path of this particular Orthodox way of looking at things, asks that we be more silent. And there are three rules for that too. The rule is this. You can say anything you like if A, it's true. B, it is kind. And C, it is necessary. If we were to keep these rules, I would say 98% of our conversations would stop. We've lost any sense of how important speaking is because we've lost all sense of how important silence is. We squander our speech. Let alone, I'm not getting in to hear about bad language and stuff, but that's okay, there's that issue as well, which exists for all of us at a plus or minus sort of stake. But I'm just talking about speech in general. Once you begin to learn to get into the silence, then speech itself is elevated to a higher level of communication. Just try it one day. Try it with people you know, because people you don't know, they're going to think you're... So try it with people you know, and just cut out anything which isn't true, or isn't kind, or isn't necessary. Cut it out. You won't die. Your mind will tell you you're going to die, but you won't. I want to bring up a couple of things from the Divine Liturgy, one of which you don't hear. At least, I'm used to the silent prayers being silent. So when in this church, the silent prayers are said out loud. It's very confusing for me. But anyway, that's fine. I'm not complaining. I'm just that's how it is. But before you guys come in on a Sunday morning, or before most of you are there, the priest behind the screen is at the table preparation, and he cuts the bread in a particular and very beautiful way. And he says a line, as he cuts out the part which will become the communion, which we call the lamb, he reads a part from, I think it's Isaiah, which refers to lamb, and it's this: as a lamb is led to the slaughter, so opened he not his mouth, where he refers to, in our understanding, to Jesus. I don't know that sheep are silent when they're being led to slaughter. I've never... My only images of slaughterhouses, and I have a number, don't include much silence. In fact, they're horribly noisy places. But I do remember being in Istanbul, a.k.a. Constantinople, one year. It was our Christmas, but it was round about the time that the Turks celebrate the feast of Kurban Bayram, which has another name, Eid el-Fatah or something in Arabic. I have no Arabic at all, so I probably just said something terrible. But anyway, which commemorates the sacrifice of Abraham, our friend Abraham. And at that time, it's common for each family to go and buy a sheep, a live sheep, and then you take it home, then you string it up and you cut its throat, and then you have a wonderful feast, and the whole city is full of blood. But I was just so taken with all these sheep happily being led along like dogs on a leash back. I mean, whether they knew they were being sacrificed or not, I don't know what they... I'm not sure what goes on a sheep's head. Not very much, I don't think. But anyway, I think it's an interesting fact, because the silence here of the Savior is not a passive silence. Because Jesus wasn't led to crucifixion passively. He went for us. He went with a purpose. He went willingly. But he went silently. This shows just a little of the power of silence. Far from being a nothing, it's an everything. And then the other example from the Divine Liturgy, which you do hear, although sometimes it's ironic in a very odd way, and choir mistresses and choir masters, please forgive me, I used to be a choir master myself, so I can get away with this. The words, "Let us now lay aside all the cares of this life, that we may receive the King of all, invisibly surrounded by the ranks of angels," which is at the heart of our hesychasm, Let us now lay aside all the cares of this life. I very often presented to the congregation in the most gothic, dressed-up, musical way possible. We tend to have lack of simplicity around the cherubic hymn. But those are the words, and they mean what they say. Let us now lay aside all the cares of this life. The church is inviting the church to leave the head and go into the heart in order to perform the Eucharistic liturgy. That's exactly what the deacon says when he shouts out, "Proskomen, pay attention, let us attend." At one level, it's simply meaning, if you're making a noise, stop making a noise. But I think in your parish, you're not into that. I've known Greek parishes where it means what it says. But here, it's a question of being, of lifting up your awareness. Proskomen, let us attend. So, you're aware here, we're now going to go up to that level. We're now going to go up to that level. And then, when we get up there, then we lift up our hearts and we're almost popping. We're almost exploding with focus and attention. Dag Hammarskjöld, even now an underrated man, who was the General Secretary of the United Nations and died very tragically in a plane accident, was a quiet sort of mystic. It had nothing to do with the Orthodox Church as far as I know, although that I don't know. But he said something like this: be understanding within the silence. Act out of stillness. Conquer in the stillness. We've got to adjust the way we think, or we have to stop thinking altogether, and become aware that silence isn't a hole in the ground which we thought it was, and which our minds certainly think it is, but it is the language of God Himself. And that if you listen to it with intent and concentrate every ounce of your being, then you will find it is as eloquent, if not more eloquent, than any number of words in any language could possibly be. Thank you very much.